Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com.
Listen now as Dr. Heaney shares clinical data and insights regarding current therapy for managing vaso-occlusive crisis in patients with sickle cell disease.
The diagnosis of sickle cell disease vaso-occlusive pain has been attempted to be captured by the American Pain Society with diagnostic criteria. Of course, first one must have the diagnosis of sickle cell disease confirmed and then have a report of increased pain that's at least 2 hours in duration and started within the past 10 days. And the patient must display one of the following signs at least, where palpation of the region of reported pain elicits pain or tenderness, movement of the region also elicits pain, and that there's decreased range of motion or weakness in the region of the reported pain. The pain also cannot be entirely explained by any other specific exam findings, such as leg ulcers, priapism, or other imaging findings, such as bone infarct or osteomyelitis and the like. But this is an important reminder that there are no reliable objective indicators that can be used to indicate the presence or severity of sickle cell disease vaso-occlusive pain. So there are no vital signs that can confirm or refute the diagnosis of sickle cell VOC pain. There are no laboratory evaluation or radiologic findings that can either support or refute it. And therefore, the patient's self-report is truly the gold standard of why of sickle cell pain and how it's identified. And this is something that we still challenge every day. And even on our inpatient service recently, one of our pain physicians was saying, but there's no laboratory abnormalities to support that. In terms of doing pain assessments, we rely based on age and the developmental capacity of the child. We can rely on face rating scales, such as the Wong-Baker scale or the FACES pain scale. And then there are also numeric rating scales for older patients and adolescents, such as the numerical rating scale or visual analog scale. The most important thing about a pain assessment and using these scales is that they need to be used frequently. Nothing is more challenging than assessing a patient once in the beginning of the day, making adjustments to pain management, and then not reassessing that frequently throughout the day to see whether your changes in management have actually benefited the patient. So what are the principles for the management of sickle cell disease acute vaso-occlusive pain? Well, guidelines generally or typically promote the following general principles. We want the rapid clinical assessment and initiation of analgesics. We want to make sure that we involve the patient, understanding what maneuvers or treatments they may have attempted at home already before coming to the medical facility. What are their typical effective analgesics and what doses? And how does current pain compare to their typical vaso-occlusive pain? Is this something somehow different in character? We also want to make sure we optimize the use of non-pharmacologic management and potentially integrative approaches. So providing fluid to allow for euvolemia, heat to allow for vasodilatation and comfort, use of cognitive behavioral therapies and other things, integrative approaches such as TENS units, virtual reality, acupuncture, and the like. Really, the backbone of what we do as physicians mostly is the pharmacologic management, starting with non-opioids, rising to opioids, and then a variety of potential adjuvants are available. And really, as I mentioned already, the frequent reassessment of that pain and potentially readministration of analgesics if their pain is not captured, meaning that the patient hasn't had some improvement in their pain to a point where they're actually able to do some of their activities of daily living. And then monitoring and anticipating the analgesic side effects, particularly the opioid side effects with stool regimens, anti-nauseants, antipruritics, and incentive spirometry will save you a lot of trouble in the long run. So you're probably all familiar with the World Health Organization's analgesic ladder, starting after all the non-pharmacologic approaches, using non-opioids such as Tylenol, moving up to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and then eventually into opioids. And we climb up this ladder with incomplete pain relief in the patient. And just like a staircase, as I tell the children, just because you've gone up a step, you don't want to get rid of the step underneath or the staircase will collapse. So just because you've added an NSAID to something like acetaminophen, you need to continue the acetaminophen. Similarly, if you add an opioid, that's not a reason to stop your NSAID. And then ultimately, as the patient improves over time, you can peel away from the top step down And the last things you're going to peel away are the non-pharmacologic supports. And then sometimes when you get to the top of this analgesic ladder, there are other adjuvant therapies such as ketamine infusions or ketamine boluses, the use of transdermal medications such as lidocaine, or even the use of regional anesthesia if you're unable to control the pain with the opioids.
That was a great overview of vaso-occlusive crisis management. Next, Dr. Heaney will review current treatments for patients with sickle cell disease.
So fetal hemoglobin has been a therapeutic target for a long time, since the realization that the naturally occurring elevated fetal hemoglobin results in improved mortality and decreased morbidity. And so this led to a series of clinical trials in adults. Initially, the multicenter study of hydroxyurea, the MSH trial, which showed the increase in fetal hemoglobin, the decrease in hemolysis and improved hemoglobin, the decrease in white cells with myelosuppression, and about a 40% reduction in painful crises, about a 50% reduction in acute chest syndrome, and then about a 50% reduction in the number and volume of transfusion. In two larger, longer-term follow-ups, one of the MSH population and one, the LYCON study, showed that longer use of hydroxyurea in adults resulted in significant reductions in mortality. The 2014 expert panel report, as I could circle here in red at the bottom, it's recommended that all infants age 9 months of age or older, regardless of clinical severity, should be offered hydroxyurea, which is quite strong language for a federal report. To be offered really means this is something that should be considered strongly. So antioxidant therapy is another approach. Oxidative stress is believed to be involved in the pathophysiology of sickle cell disease, that sickle cell red cells are more susceptible to oxidative damage. And this led to the treatment of L-glutamine, an amino acid precursor for the synthesis of essential metabolic redox factors. And it can be utilized because in sickle cell patients, the redox capacity of L-glutamine is exceeded. And so giving supplemental glutamine is thought to be able to deplete or decrease that oxidative stress. So L-glutamine was FDA approved for the indication to reduce the acute complications of sickle cell disease in adult and pediatric patients aged greater than 5 years. It's an oral formulation that's given twice daily as a powder. It's dissolved in 8 ounces of water or 4 ounces of applesauce or yogurt. And it's depending on your weight, whether you have 1, 2, or 3 packets twice a day. The primary side effect profile is that of headache, and gastrointestinal complications such as nausea, abdominal discomfort, and constipation. Another approach is to alter the oxygen affinity of hemoglobins. Voxelotor is a once daily oral small molecule which binds very selectively to the amino terminus of alpha globin and allosterically stabilizes hemoglobin in the oxygen-bound formation, thus increasing the oxygen affinity and lowering the P50. And so the goal here was to try and prevent polymerization of sickle hemoglobin and ultimately sickling of red cells, thus prolonging the red cell half-life and increasing hemoglobin overall. So voxelotor has been approved by the FDA for the treatment of sickle cell disease in adults and pediatric patients greater than 4 years of age. But this was a conditional approval under accelerated approval with contingent upon verification of description of continued clinical benefit and confirmatory trials, which are yet to be done. The formulation is oral. It's given once daily in children over age 12 or over 40 kilograms. It's the 1,500 milligrams or 3 500 milligram tablets daily. And then in weight-based dosing using 300 milligram tablets that can be used for suspension down to age 4. The side effects are primarily related to headache or gastrointestinal with abdominal pain, nausea, and loose stools. And again, this medication is provided mostly through specialty pharmacies. Another approach, given how much we know the white blood cell plays a role in the pathophysiology of vaso-occlusion, was to potentially blockade leukocytes' contributions to that. And so crizanlizumab was a P-selectin-specific humanized monoclonal antibody. It was designed to block the interactions of P-selectin with P-selectin glycoprotein ligand 1, its major binding partner, on white cells and endothelium. The use of crizanlizumab in sickle cell patients to try and prevent vaso-occlusive crisis was effective. Those patients on high-dose crizanlizumab had a reduction of the mean vaso-occlusive rate annually from almost 3 to 1.6, so almost a reduction of almost 50%, and this was statistically significant. So crizanlizumab was also FDA approved, but this is to reduce the frequency of vaso-occlusive crises in adults and pediatric patients aged 16 and above with sickle cell disease. This is an IV administered drug. It's given in over 30 minutes, although can be given more slowly in some patients. This requires loading doses 2 weeks apart for the first two doses and then continuing monthly thereafter. The side effect profile of crizanlizumab includes nausea, abdominal pain, body aches, low-grade fever, and headache. And again, it's prescribed through infusion centers only. It's not to be given at home.
Next, Dr. Shaw will review investigational agents under development for patients with sickle cell disease.
Inclacumab is a P-selectin inhibitor, which is fully human as compared to the humanized version that crizanlizumab is. It has been safely demonstrated in non-sickle cell patients for anti-cell adhesion effect in a good number of patients, but these were healthy volunteers and cardiovascular patients. So now the focus is, can we use inclacumab as an agent for patients with sickle cell? So there's an ongoing placebo-controlled study to evaluate its use. An advantage here would be potentially that it's a Q3-month dosing, every 3 months dosing, as opposed to crizanlizumab, which is every month. Now, the ongoing studies that we have are, to start with, a placebo-controlled study to evaluate the three-month dosing, as I mentioned, for VOCs during a 48-week period. And secondly, which is actually quite interesting, looking at a placebo-controlled trial of a single-dose administration to reduce readmissions in 90 days. We do have to recognize that patients with sickle cell disease have a very high 30-day readmission rates that are between 30 and 40%, of course, dependent on age, but really a big issue within our care for patients with sickle cell. Now, interleukin inhibitors are another interesting intervention that's being looked at. What we need to recognize here is that activation of inflammasomes, which are really just proteins that help that promote the inflammatory cascade, and that includes the cleavage of pro-IL-1B, which is pro-interleukin-1B, to its active form, which is IL-1B. And that subsequently activates further the inflammatory cascade. And so what we have now is the evaluation of canakinumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that inhibits IL-1B. And they've recently actually completed their first effort for this. It was a placebo-controlled trial to evaluate monthly sub-Q dosing to change the average VAS pain scores in patients, and they included patients between the ages of 8 and 20. I have a couple just real preliminary results to mention here. You know, they showed a modest decrease in the number of hospitalizations, 0.9 versus 1.1, a fair numerically but not statistically significant decrease in hospitalizations, mean 6 versus 16, and fewer opioid days. What you can see on the right here is that the graph shows that you have wide standard deviations, which are always expected in sickle cell disease, but you know, you see this trend towards pain and fatigue being slightly lower, so that they're moving into considering what are the next aspects of them evaluating this drug for patients with sickle cell. Pyruvate kinase activators have actually made a lot of effort to try and show their potential benefit, and so there's actually two drugs that we'll talk about. But at its root here, the red blood cells we have to recognize with hemoglobin S are prone to deoxygenation. We just had Dr. Heaney show very nicely where the oxygen dissociation curve is actually shifted to the right inappropriately, and that actually promotes this deoxygenation for those hemoglobin S within the red blood cell. And so this decreased oxygen affinity is also led to by the fact that there's an increase in 2,3-DPG in patients with sickle cell. Now, so the mechanism of pyruvate kinase activators is to improve ATP, which helps with promoting this cascade here. And I don't want you to go back to med school days or go crazy with trying to remember these cascades, but increasing ATP and decreasing 2,3-DPG then lead to an improvement in hemolysis markers. And so we have two separate mechanisms here, improving ATP and then decreasing 2,3-DPG, which helps with that oxygen dissociation curve. Now, the two agents I mentioned that are under investigation are mitapivat and etavopivat, both being performed concurrently by two different efforts. And I'll start with some of the data that's been presented for mitapivat, and that is showing that a dose-dependent decrease in 2,3-DPG levels, as well as an increase in ATP, which again fully supports the mechanism of action, and a follow-up where these levels return to baseline at the conclusion of the study. The mean hemoglobin at the end of a twice-daily dosing, and that is one difference between the two drugs, the mitapivat is a twice-daily drug, it was 1.2 grams per deciliter and 56% increased by 1 gram per deciliter. And that line in the sand was drawn by Voxelotor team, and that's what led to their approval. And that was, as again, as Dr. Heaney described, 51% were able to reach that. So encouraging results by the mitapivat efforts. And that's followed by the atavopivat as well, where the hemoglobin is also increasing over 1 gram by 76% of the patients in their initial studies, and a maximal mean increase of 1.5 grams. So the studies are underway for both of these agents. There are placebo-controlled trials for atavopivat to evaluate hemoglobin and VOC response, VOC rates at 24 weeks, and then also for the mitapivat, looking at safety and clinical laboratory changes.
Wow, that was great commentary on agents we have to look forward to that are under development for sickle cell disease. Next, Dr. John Sant shares relevant data and expert commentary about addressing the psychosocial healthcare needs of patients with sickle cell disease.
Managing mental health in sickle cell, of course, is very challenging due to the severe and unpredictable nature of the disease. And you combine that with exposures to chronic psychosocial stressors and disadvantaged environments and the lifestyles that many of our patients are living through. In an ongoing national trial, we asked adults with sickle cell disease this particular question. Over the last 2 weeks, how often have you been bothered by thoughts that you would be better off dead or hurting yourself in some way? Among the almost 200 patients who completed this question, 22% said yes, several days or more, I feel like hurting myself or I'd be better off dead. When not treated, these mental health symptoms can lead to more pain and exacerbate medical complications. One systematic review of the literature found that patients with SED who reported elevated depressive symptoms are 2.3 times more likely to experience a hospitalization for pain compared to their non-depressed counterparts. So given that mental health, psychosocial stress are so important for the health of our patients, what can we do? For ideas on where to start, we can look at the biopsychosocial model adapted to fit the common experience of those with sickle cell disease. Using this model, we can pinpoint targets for intervention. Several types of behavioral treatments exist, including mindfulness-based stress reduction, psychodynamic therapy, music and art therapy, and others. But what has been considered the gold standard behavioral treatment for mental health is cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is essentially a directed therapy that works with patients to change their thinking patterns and behaviors to improve their response to stress and mood. CBT is traditionally delivered in person, face-to-face with a therapist. But there are few CBT therapists available, and patients often have to travel long distances to find a therapist. And when they do finally find a therapist, it is questionable whether that therapist is culturally competent, let alone a therapist who's familiar with sickle cell. And then once you've overcome all of these barriers, there is the cost. Thus, there is a major evidence practice gap. We have this evidence-based practice and we can't actually get it to our patients. But one thing we are able to get to all patients is technology. For most of our patients, they have access to a smartphone or a computer. And over the last two decades, digital CBT, that's essentially just therapy delivered over your computer or digital device, has really exploded onto the scene. Typically, these programs are a combination of e-learning plus personalized support, a real live person that is available remotely and serves as a health coach to help encourage you to engage with the CBT program. And the data suggests that CBT really works. In fact, some studies have actually shown that the effects of digital CBT on depression and anxiety is similar to that for face-to-face therapy. We find similar results for pain. Systematic reviews show that digital CBT has positive effects for decreasing pain and disability in children, adolescents, and adults. Given the data on CBT and the ease of delivering it remotely, The UK has actually made digital CBT standard of care and available to all patients. And in the US, digital CBT is being offered as a low-cost add-on to routine care by some health plans. But still, given all this, there is a question of whether CBT will work with sickle cell disease patients. There are a few studies that have been done, but the most recent study was completed by Dr. Tanya Palermo and her team, and it's a randomized controlled trial testing cognitive behavioral therapy versus education. What is being tested is this program called I Can Cope. And I Can Cope is an evidence-based digital CBT program that was tailored specifically for adolescents with sickle cell disease. The study enrolled 137 participants and demonstrated excellent retention, with 91% of the youth completing post-treatment assessments and 86% completing six-month follow-up. More importantly, CBT was associated with a better improvements in average pain intensity from baseline to 6 months as compared to education. Similarly, they detected the same pattern for numbers of days with pain, where adolescents in the CBT group demonstrated a statistically significant reduction in pain days that was 37.4% lower than the education group at 6 months. Now, there is a second study being conducted by our group here at the University of Pittsburgh. This is also a randomized controlled trial to test the difference between digital CBT and digital education on pain outcomes in sickle cell disease. But this study, we're testing a very similar app to that of I Can Cope, a digital CBT app tailored for patients with sickle cell disease. But this one is tailored for adults with sickle cell. Both interventions, both the CBT and the education arm, are receiving a health coach, somebody who remotely provides support and encouragement along the way. Most of the health coaches in this study are actually peers with sickle cell disease or family members of somebody with sickle cell. So far, the study has been quite successful for randomization. We've randomized 358 adults with SCD and chronic pain across the US. There are no outcomes for the study yet, but an engagement in the study has been historically high for sickle cell trials. And we've conducted over 1,200 coaching sessions by phone or text message. For the most part, these are patients that would have never received behavioral care without this study. So already, we feel like we are providing more service to those patients who are in need of mental health or behavioral health care. In fact, one patient on the study said, "I don't need to get pain treatment this week because I get to speak to my health coach." And we have several other anecdotal stories similar to this one, suggesting that the behavioral support that they're receiving from this trial is helpful for addressing their stress and their pain. Again, the data is still being collected, and we don't know whether digital CBT is going to be effective for mental health and pain in sickle cell, but we know for certain it's not going to make patients worse, and it won't lead to any side effects.
Listen now as Dr. Shaw shares best practices for helping your patients with sickle cell disease transition from pediatric to adult care.
What I think is a good reminder is what is the definition of transition? And I show this because I pulled this right out of the recommended article from the Journal of Adolescent Health, that it's multifaceted, which is understandable, but that's really everything. That means medical, psychosocial, educational, vocational needs. And this is something that happens also in the healthcare facility. So not just the patient that needs to have the transition consideration, but the facilities have to consider this as well. And finally, the last part of this puzzle is the recognition that every patient is different. Each patient is going to transition at a different rate. And so we have to make this kind of conversation and these type of efforts malleable. We have to make sure that we're able to care for our patients differently and as needed. So we start with what are the challenges to patients with any chronic disease? And this is something that we see evidence for across many different diseases. And that includes not being able to take care of their disease and not being able to cope with the fact that they have a chronic disease. Added to the fact, and more so even with the advent of newer medications that are costly, but the cost of care and the uncertainty of where they're going to go with that care or not is really a big burden to patients. And now you layer onto that this concept with sickle cell disease that they're now having specific concerns about their disease. They have, of course, as was outlined as well, in previous discussions that this is a population that has been marginalized and it is a population that is historically socioeconomically challenged. And the transition program then leads to having some success on the pediatric side, but then there's a little bit, honestly, a little bit of a ball drop when they get to the adult side. And there are many reasons for that. We can get into some of that, but that leads to a lot of the patients who are supposed to be coming to the adult side coming back to the pediatric side and not effectively using the healthcare system. And finally, I used to say there's just not enough sickle cell docs, but the problem is not that we don't have enough sickle cell docs. We don't have enough sickle cell providers in general. That means nurses, social worker, psychologists, et cetera. We just don't have enough, and that's leading to suboptimal care, more so on the adult side, but really it's something that we need to focus on. I do want to emphasize that, you know, when you follow transition experts and look at what is it that we're trying to recommend, there's no standardization. I mean, so we have different recommendations from different areas, but there's no standardized practice across the board. We're working towards it, and there are definitely guidelines and there are good things to leverage. But as of right now, and that's really because of the fact that there are a lot of variability into transition programs across the country. Now, the barriers that are there are trying to be addressed. I mean, there are many patients, and there was actually a survey that showed that, you know, 29% of patients who had just moved to the adult world didn't have insurance, and that's a major issue. And that inadequate care is compounded by the fact that patients who are in pediatrics being seen ultimately don't get seen on the adult side, and this incomplete transition of care leads to bad outcomes. And in the end, we want there to be one medical home for them and have access to ambulatory care, but that's not something that we have consistently. So what are the ultimate issues that happen because of these transition problems? Well, there's an increase in utilization, and there's an increase in disease severity and complications that occur. And there's data to back this up. I mean, if you look at 30-day readmission rates, for example, you see that those patients who are in that adolescent period at 10 to 17 have a 30-day readmission rate of 23%. It almost doubles when you become 18 to 30. I mean, you see that there's this big change that occurs as they get into the adult world. Now, there are resources for programs to try and develop and make their transition program as best as they can and try to identify gaps and areas that they can improve. We've done this ourselves, and I think we were really fortunate to be part of a large PCORI grant that is a multi-center grant trying to leverage the GOT transition recommendations to improve the healthcare transition. And I will say this, and I've said this so many times, it starts with the policy. I know, and so the recommendations say policy, tracking and monitoring, then, you know, make sure you have a readiness assessment, you're planning this, that you have the actionable transfer of care, and then really make sure that you've completed that transfer. But it starts with the policy. I cannot say how many times I've gone around and ask, what are they doing? Do they have a policy? And there's not a policy in place. Start with that. And I can give you a great story. The reason I do transition is that the day I joined faculty, I had two patients. One patient was a 21-year-old that never wanted to leave pediatrics, and the pediatric group was fine with that. And they loved him. But the second patient I saw was a 16-year-old patient who was doing all the wrong things, all the drugs, sex, and alcohol at 16, and they were ready for him to move to the adult side. And so as I was trying to struggle with figuring out what was the right decision for when these patients should move to the adult side, there was no policy. And that's what, you know, where our policy came about. So I do like the GOT transition. There's actually a wealth of information. So I would absolutely recommend you going to their website. The GOT transition website has a lot of steps and a lot of resources that you can pull that will, I think, help you fill in some of those gaps and have you at least assess what you may not have in your program.
Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you would like to receive CE credit for participating in this program, visit our podcast page on our website at gotoper.com. Find the name of this program and click on the link for the post-test. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.